Mate, I've had that
Chico
before.
Time.
Some guy a few years ago stopped me in the street and he was like, oh, can I have a picture? Can I have a picture? I was like, yeah, okay, mate, no problem. And he's like, oh, thanks, man. My wife's going to love this and good luck this weekend. I was like, well, I'm not on anything this weekend. I said, sorry, this weekend? He went, Dancing on Ice. You are Chico, right?
Oh, no.
He thought I was Chico.
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
Oh, no. Well, he gets Tom, mate. He gets Tom Vandell. Do you remember Tom Vandell?
Yeah, yeah. Wow, mate, don't try to let me
out. Whenever he goes out.
Oh, hey, Tom, mate. Tom.
So welcome to another edition of After the Whistle. I'm delighted to say that we've got the rather lovely dressed Rav Wilding, looking very dapper, mate, in that jumper. But we obviously know you from the TV and the people listening from your time on Crime Watch and various different Strictly Come Dancing.
Yeah, tried.
Yeah. That went all right. Karen, was our producer, was saying earlier that you looked very good on Strictly Come Dancing.
Oh, is that right? Oh, she's the only one.
How far did you get?
Oh, I didn't get very far. I think I was week three. I was a goner on that one. Not my finest moment, but good experience.
Were any of the rugby boys in it?
Not on my year. No. We had sports wise, we had Joe Calzaghe, the boxer, really got on with him, but he and I were, you know, joint rubbish. Yeah. And then we had a guy called Richard Dunwoody who was a jockey who couldn't dance very well because he couldn't move one arm because he'd fallen off his horse so many times. So there was a few of us in the back of the room that couldn't really do anything.
Quite challenging when you're doing a salsa.
Exactly.
Did you last longer than him in it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I suppose there's that. But you know what? Good experience.
But so one thing that I was fascinated to learn when I was looking at and doing some research into chatting to you today is that actually prior to all of that, so all the celebrity, all the TV, all the presenting, actually your first port of call was 4 years in the British Army with the Parachute Regiment. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was not the Parachute Regiment. It was a Parachute Air Defence Troop, but yeah, it was part of
part. What's of the difference?
So the Parachute Regiment itself, there's three battalions, infantry battalions, so the ground fighters, if you like, and they are backed up by specialists in various fields, and my unit was a troop of 30 guys that were they used what's called a javelin, a shoulder-launched missile system to take down aircraft. So we were like the backup, if you like, to do that role.
A specific
unit, yeah, to do that. So it was what's called the Parachute Air Defence Troop, which I was part of. But I did 4 years in that, which was a baptism of fire, if you like, as a 17-year-old going into the military. It's a big man's world, if you like.
So was that always, as a boy, was that the dream? Was that the thing you wanted to do when you grew up? Was that the military?
No, so growing up, I really wanted to be in the police. My granddad on my mum's side was a police officer and his wife, so my grandmother, she was a police officer as well. And they died when I was quite young. And I know that they were so immensely proud of that. And as a boy, I was talking to them about it, and it was something they were really excited about, the prospect of me being the only one of their grandchildren that might go in the police. But I knew that the police were only recruiting people at sort of 26, 27 or older, which as a child is really, really old to anyone.
Yeah.
And I wasn't in a position to go to university. That was never going to happen. We certainly didn't have the money and I probably didn't have the brains. So that was never an option. So I needed something that was going to make me grow up quickly. And the military was exactly that. And it gave me the answers I was looking for. You know, it gave me a home. I needed a home, somewhere to live. It gave me money. It gave me the opportunity to play lots of sport. And it seemed to tick a lot of boxes. So that's why I went in there.
What was home life like then? Was it, you know, was there a harsh upbringing? Was it tough?
Yeah, it was pretty tough. I mean, I'm not going to get the violins out, but it was tough. So I was in a small industrial town in Kent. It was pretty tough. It was a lot of the people worked in industry, in the paper mill or the brick factory, and it was a tough area. It was a very, very white area. My dad was black and one of the first people of colour to move into the town, and we got a lot of stick for that. And it was pretty tough as a mixed race kid growing up there. We got a lot of abuse. I got abuse as a toddler, getting racial abuse in front of my dad, and that was kind of hard.
As a toddler,
we
had things. To you or to your dad?
I remember driving in the car and having stones and bricks thrown at the car and racial abuse being slung at him and words about me being a half-breed kid, you know. And as a kid, as a toddler, hearing that was pretty hard for doing nothing wrong, you know. So things like that stuck with me. And it wasn't an easy upbringing. There wasn't a lot of money in the family. We had a lot of financial trouble. And when I got to sort of 16, 17... I needed to find somewhere to live. There was nowhere for me to live. So the army kind of ticked a lot of boxes and gave me that home, gave me that sort of security that I needed. And I was thinking would get me into the police a few years later.
And did you, so when you moved into the army, obviously the dream was the police, but you went down the military route. Did you find any similar racial issues, did you, or was it a completely different environment?
I found the army was totally different. I was in a pretty specialist unit, so you had to earn your stripes, if you like. You had to do a lot of selection tests to get into the unit I was in. And I think once you'd done that, you kind of proven yourself. And the guys that I was in the unit with accepted you because of what you'd done and what you could bring to the team. And I think, I mean, you'll know more, but it's probably a lot like a rugby team where it doesn't matter what their background is, what they look like, you know, what their parents look like. If that person stood next to you in the back line or in the scrum or whatever is doing their job and has got your back and you've got theirs, I don't think it really matters where they are. And that's what I found in the army. They didn't give me any stick for my upbringing whatsoever. Of course, they had some nicknames. My nickname is nothing bad. It was Jonah, the baby Jonah, they called me, because Drake Jonah Loma was around at the time.
Okay, well, that's nice. Massive compliment.
That's a decent nickname.
Yeah, I was Jonah for 4 years, which is, there are worse nicknames, aren't there? Because he was absolutely dominating the rugby field at the time. So that was my nickname.
I got called that quite a lot.
Did you?
Yeah, Jonah.
Never
yeah.
that.
Did
never
you?
Happened once.
Just in my house.
Everyone wants that.
Just
one.
In my house. Just
yeah. I mean, this is the late 90s, you know, so he really was on fire.
He was
the time.
Man. Yeah. Sadly, obviously, not with us anymore.
I know.
But what a
guy, eh?
But I remember playing in a game against Jonah.
Did you?
For the first time, 2002. And I'd never, ever been scared of an opponent, ever. Because you can't be, right? Was, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember going on the field with him and thinking, whoa, okay. He is massive.
Really?
We had, you know, your classic sort of skinny English wingers. He was like 18, Leon Lloyd.
Right, Leon.
We met him.
I was playing that game.
And then you look at Joan Lomi, he's like 18, 19 stone, quicker, stronger, more powerful than any of us. And I remember being stood next to Phil Vickery and thinking, okay, good news. So he's lined up against Jonah, at least he's 20 odd stone. I was what, 16, 17. You know, he'll definitely be able to stop him. Jonah got the ball, literally dispatched Phil Vickery like he wasn't even there, you know. And I was like, what'd you do?
I
literally just jumped on his back until I think Phil maybe put a big enough dent in his speed that I could jump on his back and then enough of us could take him down. But
that's never happened before in a game. That must have been a game changer for you.
Mate, it was the transition into the modern era, isn't it, for me? Because he was the anomaly.
Yeah.
Whereas all of a sudden now we've got, you know, the league's proliferated with massive wingers and across the field, you know, everyone's enormous now, aren't they? We definitely wouldn't our skinny little frames wouldn't survive these days. But
oh, I'm not so sure.
Yeah,
I'm
but anyway, so, so sure. you were mini Jonah.
I was baby accurate. Jonah for 4 years, which was a pretty good compliment.
You played rugby anyway, though.
We played rugby in there. Now, the army's made, or certainly was in my experience, predominantly of northern lads, and most of them played rugby league as opposed to rugby union. So we played probably a lot more league than union, which I enjoyed playing. I don't really enjoy watching it as much, but to play it is pretty good. You get your hands on the ball quite a lot, and I think physically my size, I mean, I was a lot smaller than I am now, but my size didn't really matter as much in league, I don't think, because the way the game's not as different between the props and the second rows and whatever you have in union. But we had a lot of Kiwis that came over on exchange as well, and Australian Special Forces soldiers that sort of joined our unit for a little while and got to play with them as well, which was great, great experience. Yeah, and of course they assumed, because of the way I looked, that I was going to play like Jonah Loma, which didn't happen. So it was a bit of a letdown 30 seconds after kickoff. But yeah, it was good. Good experience.
I know are there any particular memories that you have from your time? So the 4 years, was it the 5th Battalion that you were with? Any real fond memories, moments? Did you deploy?
No, so when I was there, nothing had really happened. So I've been out there since, but Afghanistan hadn't happened. And that's probably my biggest regret, because I was always going to do about 6 or 8 years. That was my plan, to do that long in the military. And then I broke my leg quite badly in a training exercise, and it basically never recovered. And the doctor's like, look, this is never going to get better. You've got to go, because it was such a physical unit I was in. And then suddenly in my very early 20s, I was out. And it was like, well, now what? And my biggest regret wasn't breaking my leg. It was not being able to go on active service. Because I thought, what's the point of being in the military and not doing it? It's like joining the fire brigade and never putting out a fire. In my head, that's genuinely how I felt. Yeah. And it was a couple of years after I left, I managed to go back for nearly a month to Afghanistan with my old unit who were deployed out there. And at least I got to see it. I know it's not the same, but I got to see it and go out into the literally into some of the most hostile areas and see what the troops
in
had
what,
to go
in what
through.
Context were you out there in
so I was filming around. I was filming right, about you. The military yeah. and about what they go through and about the living conditions, about everything really, and I saw a lot, I mean a lot, which you never see on the news, about the harsh reality of what they go through, you know, just day to day.
How is that for you though? If you think about your time yeah, in the military coming out, to go back and see that, having not experienced it, how was that?
It was good because I got to see it. It was good because I got to see some of my mates who were still there, but it was awful when I knew that I was coming home and I was leaving them and thinking, well, I'm going home, I'm getting on the plane. And they don't even know if they're ever going to go home. So that was hard.
Sorry. There was a fairly, was there a bomb blast or there was an incident that happened whilst you're out there?
Yeah, I was there and I was doing a chat to the camera and there was, as any of you will know, when you do filming it, any noises and whatever, you have to stop and start again because the sound people are like, no, it's too noisy, we have to do it again. So, and there was this big noise and they were like, yeah, we're going to have to do that again. And I was like, no, what was that noise? And the lad I was talking to said, no, that's a bomb blast. That's someone's just set off a bomb. And one of the soldiers came running over to us and was like, Raven, really sorry, that noise, that was our sergeant. He's just been killed. And literally while we were recording, the noise was their guy that they have lived in each other's pockets for months. And he was literally killed, like metres from where we were. And it was awful. And obviously we were filming at the time, and out of respect to his family, obviously we were never going to show that footage unless his family was spoken to, and we spoke to his wife, and after they told her the news and said, just so you know, they were filming at the time, would you mind if they spoke about this on TV? She said, no, absolutely, please do, because I want people to know what we go through as the family as well. And she gave us her full permission, and we were able to film when the news was broke to the rest of the troops who didn't know what had happened. And it was utterly chilling to be there when the colonel came out and was like, right, boys, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to tell you some awful news. And just relax, boys. And he told them what had happened. And seeing scores of these hardened men just in floods of tears about their you know, best mate, if you like, that had just been killed just in a split second. It was awful.
That must have been really tough for your crew as well, because the guys who were in there, when you sign up to something like that, we talked to Colonel David Richmond and to Wayne before about, you sign up, you sort of know, you hope it never happens, but you sort of know what you're signing up for. So for them to be able to affect them in that way, it must have been harder for the crew that you were out there with, or I presume were not military people, to also experience that, to the knock-on effects.
It was hard. There was only me and one person filming it, so it wasn't like a big TV crew. It was just me and one guy with a camera. But it was still really, really hard because it was the reality of what we're dealing with. And even before that, we were filming and there was a chef, and he was in the middle of what they call a forward operating base, it's called. Basically the size of a football field. And that was where all these troops were living, working, doing everything. And he was trying to cook for all these troops, right? Hundreds of troops. And he was one chef on his own. And I said, oh, he's really grumpy, this chef. He's really grumpy. And I went up and I was like, you know, I'll talk to anyone. And I said, oh, mate, you know, how's things? He's like, I can't work like this. I can't work in these conditions. And I thought he was either talking about the heat or the sand or the humidity, whatever it was. And what is it? And he's like, look. And he showed me all his pots and pans that were hanging up above him, and they all had holes in. And the holes were bullet holes because the insurgents were hiding and shooting at him in the middle and hitting his pots and pans. That's what he was moaning about. And I was like, to be fair, guys, he's moaning about being shot at every day.
You might be a bit grumpy today.
And they get so used to the situation they were living in. To them, that was normal. But for an outsider, he's actually been shot at. I think he's got genuine cause to have a little bit of a whinge.
Would you have been able to say that to him? Because is that something?
Yeah, I did. And I think they like that. The fact that I was in the army before and, you know, I'm not coming out as a journalist, you know, straight out of Oxbridge, and this is what you do. I was talking as someone who'd kind of been there and lived with these guys just a couple of years before, and I think they appreciated that. But it was a good experience, a really good experience, and massive respect for them all.
If it hadn't broken your leg, you'd still be there.
Definitely. I would have
still been there. Maybe have transitioned to the police, maybe not, but you'd have definitely still been there.
Well, I would have certainly done a lot longer, and the unit I was in, a lot of the boys at least had a go, if not went on to serve in the Special Forces. And that was the kind of ultimate path that people would do. They'd use my unit to try and get the experience as a feeder, if you like, to get in there. Many of them did. And a lot of them, as I say, certainly had a good crack at it. And if it wasn't for serious injury or something, they'd probably be there now. So that's really where I would have wanted to go if I'd stayed. But then, yeah, went into the police and did things that way.
Let's come back, because you mentioned it during the course of that little chat there about you breaking your leg and a serious injury. So that, you know, because we've talked about transition with lots of different people and how you go from, you know, one thing to another. But that's not transition, is it? That's actually, that's total life-changing moment.
Yeah, right? it really was. And it was... It's one of these things, right? You will both know this from being former players. You get injuries and, you know, you might have a big game coming up and you think, do you know what, I'll take the painkillers, I'll just crack on, I want to get on, I need my place in the team, I owe this to my team, I'm going to do it. And I had that mentality, and I was doing this this selection course for a unit which was a lot of running every single day, carrying a lot of weight on my back, and my leg was really hurting, and I had like 4 days left of this course, and it was like a six-week course. So I was like, well, I'll just carry on. You know, I'll go through the pain and whatever. You get this tunnel vision because the end was in sight. And the pain got worse and worse and worse. And the lads were like, Rav, I was just going to go and get you some painkilling gel, or the old Ibrelief and whatever. They were running out to the shops at night, coming back, putting it on my leg. I was like, I'll be all right, I'll be all right. And then I carried on running and it literally just snapped on me. And what happened was I had a load of fractures in my tibia, which were like hairline fractures, and there was quite a few of those. That was what the pain was. And I carried on running and they just gave way and the whole leg just crumbled in three bits. It snapped. And that was it. That was the last time I've ever been able to properly run. And that was Friday, February the 13th, 1998. I remember it, yeah. And that was the last time, because my leg's never been the same again. And looking back, it was one of those stupid things, because if I just stopped, let the hairline fractures heal, 6 months later, I'll be able to have another go.
So did you know you had those fractures before?
No, I just thought it was a really sore leg. It was just something, whatever it was. I mean, I certainly wasn't medically trained in any
way,
shape,
or
form.
You're seeing 4 days left of 6 weeks of hard training. If I stop now, I've got to do the 6 weeks again. Yeah.
And you look at any of the lads, right? We just had the World Cup. Look at any of the boys in 4 days before the World Cup final. If any of them had a sore leg, and they were, are they going to go, do you know what, Eddie, this isn't for me, sorry.
I'll get the next one.
You just wouldn't, would you? You'd have a go. And I'm sure you both played through some pretty serious injuries and got on with it. And it was that kind of mentality, which at the time you feel kind of noble for doing it, being brave and whatever. Yeah. But in hindsight, it was the worst thing I could have done.
Yeah. It's funny how these things creep up on you, isn't it? Because sometimes, like listening to you talk about that, I remember going through exactly similar moments where you just pushing through the pain barrier, because you know, you get used to those sort of different levels of pain and trying to understand, you know, what is serious and what's not. And actually that becomes really counterproductive, because you get to a point where you push too hard and then you set yourself back. But so from that point of view, when did you realize you weren't going to be able to then continue in the army?
Well, it took months and months and months after breaking it, and I kept going back to hospital and they were x-raying it again and again, and it still wasn't healing. It just wasn't healing the way they wanted. And I remember they kept putting the a new cast on every time. And I've got probably rugby players' thighs. I've got big thighs. And I measured my good thigh and it was 26 inches round. And when the cast came off on the bad leg, it was under 14.
Wow.
And if you think, you know, whatever your collar size is, it's less than your neck, you know, a lot less than your neck. And that was pretty harsh. Well,
Lewis is about 14
Lewis has
now.
Gone down now. He's about 13 and a half
14
now.
Inches, but it's the same as damage around both his legs. That alone right now.
I'm thinking, God, I'd love to get to 14 around the thighs.
And it was, it just wasted away so much. And then in the end, the doctors they put me in another unit, which was, you know, with the greatest of respect, it wasn't what I joined to do. It was like a transport unit, and it was lads just sitting around drinking tea and not doing the sort of physical training that we would have done. And I had to see my mates go off and do the special forces training and go off and do that side of things. And it was really harsh. And I just thought, you know, I can't do this. And then the doctors looked and they said, well, you're never going to be back to the level that you were at. It's game over. And that was it. And I left. And I remember just thinking, I don't know what I'm going to do. You know, I've got no home. I've got no anything. What am I going to do? And I remember just sitting there, literally had my head in my hands, and I was sitting at the breakfast table and I was like, guys, I'm leaving in 3 weeks. I've got nothing. I've got no home. I've got no job. I don't know what I'm going to do. And it was one of those weird, what I call sliding doors moments, you know, after the film. And there was this civilian girl that was sat in the breakfast room at the time. She was, I think she was a civilian admin clerk. I'd never met her before, never spoken to her before. And she's like, Rav, I'm so sorry. Well, she didn't call me by my name. She's like, I'm so sorry. I don't mean to overhear your conversation, but I couldn't help but hear what you were saying. Have you ever thought about Harrods, the security team. And I was like, what, that posh shop? Like, I've literally never stepped foot in there in my life. And she said, yeah, my husband's been trying to get in the security team there, but he's not tall enough. They want 6 foot tall blokes who are ex-military. It might be worth trying them because apparently they pay quite well. And within a few phone calls and a quick interview, I got offered the job and I was working on the doors at Harrods literally the day after I left the army. And it gave me enough to, so I managed to at least get a job and it paid okay for the time. And it was all ex-military guys and a few women as well. But yeah, it's kind of saved
me. That's an element of transition. I think what Lewis was saying before, where if you get something sudden, like in sport, that's a retirement.
Yeah.
You can't put things in place. What happened to you was that's quite sudden.
Yeah.
But I suppose if you're working in that same group of people who are ex-military, you're sort of there or thereabouts with people who understand and think the same as you. I suppose that would have been helpful that you're in that environment.
It did help. It did help because when I got told I was going to have to leave the army, I thought, well, okay, fine. Well, I'll just join the police or the fire brigade or the prison service or whatever, as a kind of natural progression, which a lot of people do.
Is it the structure? Because that's what I found.
A lot of people would do that. And that's you'd be drawn to those professions. And I applied and the answers came back every single time. No, we're not going to touch you with that leg. And the police, it was the fire service actually, they were quite honest. And they said, what happens if you fall over 4 years after we take you on and we pension you off for the rest of your life because of that leg? We can't afford to take that risk. That's when it hit me that I was on my own because I just assumed I would go into one of those professions. And then suddenly when it wasn't there, it was panic stations. I'd nothing. But yeah, Harrods took me on and that sort of saved me. And I worked there on the doors for probably not a long time, probably 9 months, something like that. And it was whilst I was there that my boss, who was an ex-police officer, said, Rav, you don't need to be doing this. Have another crack at the police. And I did apply and I was probably a little bit more selective about my medical history, if I'm honest. And
did he give you advice in terms of that?
I was too honest. And I'm not saying it was particularly, I don't know, make your minds up whether I was right or wrong in to do that. But I said less about it. It came up in the medical. There was probably a 103-year-old doctor who said, oh, tell me about this broken leg. Yeah. I was like, oh, I can barely remember it.
Yeah.
It was so minor and so, you know, had so little impact on my life. And then he signed me off and I got in the police.
Yeah. It seems you've had it amputated. What?
It's
grown back, it's fine.
Thing, yeah, flesh wound.
It's, you know, stuff like that is annoying though, isn't it? Because maybe it's a sort of product of the world that we're in now, is that it's almost, I don't know whether this is the right word, but it's like future-proofing. So they're like almost, they don't want to take the gamble if there's anything that could go wrong in the future.
Exactly that. And it'll probably be similar to a rugby player changing teams and a team doing a medical and saying, well, we're not sure we're going to take that risk. Because what if it falls on our shoulders in a year when you're not playing? You know, it could be the same as that. And that was annoying to me because they didn't give me a crack.
Yeah.
And that's what was
and
annoying.
And you were young.
Early 20s. And then I managed to get in the police and it was fine. And I did over 8 years in a really, really busy station in South London, in Peckham, which was one of the busiest ones in the UK. And it didn't slow me down in any way, shape or form. So it just shows that you can do it if you're just given the option.
Lots of roles in the police. What did you do? Were you like a walk in the beat?
I mean, it's slightly different now, but at the time, everyone that joined would do uniform first and then you can progress into other things if you want to do that. So I did start off in uniform, walking a bit of the beat. I worked on a big estate called the North Peckham Estate, which had a very well-known killing on there when I was there, of Damilola Taylor. That was there when I was there. So I was assigned to that estate to do community policing, walking around the beach, showing a bit of high visibility presence on there, which was pretty horrible, really, for, you know, you got people that lived there all their lives and that was their home, and then to have this horrible thing happen on the doorstep. I did that. And then, again, sliding doors moment. I was playing rugby with a lad that had just joined my station. He was in a team and he said, oh, I'm just coming to Peckham. I'm going to be the new DI there on the CID, which is a detective inspector. We played well together. And he said, I'd like you to come and work with me, do your application form for CID and I'll sign it off for you. So that's what happened. I had no intention of going in CID, which is the sort of plainclothes.
Rugby's great, isn't it?
Rugby's it. Rugby got me in there. I only had about 2 years in, which is unheard of back in the time to go into CID.
Yeah.
Normally you'd have sort of 8 years. But we got on, the boss played alongside me and thought, yeah, I like this guy. So yeah, he signed off my application form and I started training as a detective. So that's what I dealt with. And I was there, I worked on various units dealing with sort of robberies, then burglaries, sexual offences, drug crime, guns, literally all the high-end stuff is what I dealt with, and did that in Peckham and Camberwell. So although I didn't get my active service in the military, I certainly got it there.
And how long were you with the Met until you went to the CID?
So I was only in a couple of years in uniform before I went into CID. I mean, it was all part of the Met, but the CID is just another department within it. And I probably did 6 years in the CID. So most of my service, it was plain clothes.
I should probably have known that, shouldn't I? It's probably like one of those really...
No, not really. No, I mean, it just shows you've never been in trouble. Oh, that's a good thing. Yeah.
Public schoolboy.
Yeah, is that what it is?
Never get
embarrassing.
Now, I'm interested because you mentioned the Damilola Taylor case. So what involvement did you have with that at the time? And that was massive. And I remember that being on the news. And so as a policeman that was involved in and around that, how impacting was that for you?
It was... Unfortunately, we had quite a few deaths where I worked. Stabbings, shootings... All the time. But what made that so awful was it was a 10-year-old boy. Yeah. That's what was the difference. And he was innocent. Do you know what I mean? He would literally just wrong place, wrong time. And it was, he just bled to death from a totally unnecessary attack. And it was horrible because that estate was just the most grim estate that you can imagine. Mm-hmm. It was November when it happened, so it was freezing cold anyway, but there was broken windows everywhere. There was just icy cold wind blowing through. It had just been just left. And you could just imagine the council thought, oh, we'll deal with that thing later. And that's where it happened, which was the worst place that you could imagine anyone living. It was an utter slum. And I think that's what made it even worse for that poor kid's parents to know that that's where their little boy had his last breath. You know, and that's what made it so sad. And the job that I had was then to be put on this special team to just patrol that estate and nothing else, and to walk round and round in circles for 12 hours a day to try and give some reassurance to the people that lived there. And we had some elderly women that had moved there probably in the 60s, 50s, 60s, and that was their home. And even though it all become broken and disheveled, it was at one time a nice place, and this was their home, and they'd talk to their neighbours across the walkway, and that was how they'd communicate. And it was just horrible to know that these women had just been so poorly treated that their home had just been forgotten about. And of course, they didn't want to be moved out because it was their home, even though it was just an awful crime-ridden estate now. So it was hard. It was hard. And it was hard not knowing who was responsible for a long time. And then I remember my... when I first joined, my inspector was a very, very keen, very, very switched on young guy. He was called Inspector Efgrave, and he had then gone onto a murder team, and he later became the investigator who re-examined the evidence and got a successful prosecution. So when we knew that he was on the case, we thought, well, if anyone's going to do it, it's this guy. And he did. And it was really good because I had dealings with the guys that were ultimately convicted.
And when you mean dealings?
I dealt with them in my course of a police officer. I dealt with them for various misdemeanors, if we say. When we heard it was them that had been convicted, it was good news. It was a positive result. I actually did a very long interview with Damilola's father. That was tough. And he won't mind me saying this, I know, because he's such a lovely guy, and he didn't want any special treatment or anything like that. He agreed to meet us, and he just said, can we do the interview in a hotel, and can I have a hotel room? Right, that was the two things he asked for. And I interviewed him, and it was an emotional interview. And at the end, I was talking to the producer, and I was like, he does live very, very close to where we did the interview. And and she said, yeah, he wanted the hotel room just because he knew he needed somewhere to cry afterwards. Oh. Because he couldn't go home, and it was... That's when it brings it home, you know, as a 10-year-old boy. You wouldn't wish it on anyone. So it was tough. That was a tough one for us all to deal with. And I think some of the officers felt, you know, that was a tough one for them to deal with, you know, because that's the age that a lot of people would have children of their own. You know, police officers on the front line, as we call it, a lot of them had sort of 8, 10-year-old kids. And I think that, again, brought it all home a little bit too much. You can deal with a lot of adult shootings, if you like. It's never nice. I dealt with many. But sometimes they are what we call... Well, sometimes it will say a drug deal gone wrong. No one deserves to die. But sometimes it will be an argument between two fellow gangs and one of them ends up killing the other one. It's wrong on every level, but it's very different to an innocent 10-year-old child being killed. And I think when that happened, it really hit home. yeah, a little bit too much.
You said you deal with that. How do you? I mean, because I can't comprehend. You know, having never gone through something like that. How do you deal with something like that? You know, dealing with gun violence, seeing someone die, dealing with death. You said a number of deaths during the time there. How does that?
Some things I took home more than others, I'll be honest. But it's, I don't know if there's a specific way how to deal with it, but you do kind of go into autopilot at the time, and then it's afterwards that it hits you.
Yeah.
I remember dealing with a call on the radio saying there'd just been a shooting in a nightclub, and it was in the small hours of the morning, and we turned up at this nightclub and there was no one there. It was like nothing had happened, and we get so many false alarms, you just assumed it was one of those. And then suddenly the doors burst open. All these guys came running out of this club, and this guy collapsed in my arms, and he'd been shot. You could see, they pulled his clothes up, he'd been shot in the chest. And instantly I'm compressing him and trying to stop the bleeding and calling for the ambulance. And then they're shouting over the radio and I couldn't really hear because there's so much noise. And they're calling me up again and again and again. And they're saying, we've just had another call. The gunman is still there and he wants to finish the job. So he's going to put another shot into the guy that I'm holding.
Yeah.
So I've got the choice of getting up and running away and leaving this guy to literally bleed and die, or staying there and doing it. And ultimately, that's exactly what I did. I stayed there and just hoped it wasn't going to happen, because I couldn't let this guy die. And that's what I did. And thankfully, the bloke didn't come back. And I remember it was about 2 years later, I pulled over a car, and I got quite a good recognition, facial recognition. And I was looking at this bloke, and I was like, I know you. He's like, no, you don't know me. And I was like, are you from Peckham? And he's like, no, I'm not from Peckham. I've only ever been there once. I got shot. And I was like, it's you.
Oh, really?
It was you. Yeah, by the way, you're only here because of me, mate.
Imagine how scared he'd have been. Some big guy. I know you. Aren't you from Peckham? No, definitely not. Definitely never been there.
Yeah.
Do you still keep in touch now then?
No. Just, we had a good catch-up. I mean, I'd actually pulled him over because he had something wrong with his car, I think. So I don't think we could be mates. I think he's, but anyway, he was all right. He was quite thankful that him dying at the side of the road.
As you would be, right? Yeah. Cheers, mate. Yeah. See you later anyway. Whatever.
Yeah.
So your journey there is fascinating. You've gone through many things that, you know, I certainly can't even comprehend. You then mentioned about the CID.
Mm-hmm.
And during your time there, I think you were also tasked with another sort of, was it Sapphire Unit?
Yeah, so that was the Sexual Offences Unit. And that was, as a detective, it was good because it's what you do all the training for and all the exams for, and it's like the highest thing you can deal with outside of a murder is a sexual offence. So it's really top end and it's hard. But we got some massive convictions at court, you know, which is quite a good feeling, you know, when you get some sort of justice for the victims of such horrible crimes. But that was hard, and that was the one I'd probably take home more than anything else, because if you've got a, without going into graphic detail, if you've got a victim of a sexual offence, which could be a girl, it could be an innocent woman walking down the street, it could be a wife in an abusive relationship. There's many different scenarios, but you deal with those people so much, and over so many months, if not years, you're dealing with those people, and you're really, you know, constant communication with these people. So you really get to know them very well, and they put so much trust and hope into you getting that conviction for them. So that was hard. And then the legal system's just, I don't know, it's barbaric in many ways. You know, you go to court with this, you know, there's an innocent victim of a crime, and they just get ripped apart by defence barristers who are trying to do whatever they can to persuade a jury that they've done wrong. And there's that as well that you have to deal with. It's pretty, that's hard. But, you know, if you get a guilty conviction, which we were lucky to get many of, and you got the family of the victims, and just you just see the relief, you know, when you know someone's going away for 14 years, 20 years, whatever it was that I got, you know, that was pretty satisfying.
And how long were you in?
I did a few years on the Sapphire Unit until I finished. Yeah. So I was doing that when I'd already started doing Crime Watch.
Yeah.
How did that come about? Like, how does that come about?
So they wanted, there was an advert that I didn't receive, someone sent to me, that said they wanted a police presenter. So someone who was a serving police officer to be a police presenter for the 20th anniversary in 2004. So that's when the show, 20th anniversary of the show. I was always messing around in the office and whatever, and
but like, no previous acting experience
No, never been a presenter before. I just applied and got called up and did all these screen tests, you know, like auditions basically, and there was loads of us turned up, and then they whittled it down and down and had autocues that we had to read and all sorts of little tests that they had for us. And then again, the numbers got smaller and smaller until there was just a couple of us left. And then they offered me the job and then turned up at Crime Watch. And that was an eye-opening experience, because by then I was a detective, even though they asked me to wear uniform for the show. I was a detective. I'd proven myself. I'd been in the army. You know, I'd done all these things. I was kind of pretty good at what I was doing. And then I turned up there and it was like nothing else. They just totally ignored me. No one would speak to me. It was almost like sort of Downton Abbey. There was all the producers and whatever over there. They just wouldn't even speak to me. And I was an absolute sort of outcast in many ways. And I remember we were doing the rehearsals for Crime Watch, and then suddenly everyone disappeared for a couple of hours, and they just said, oh, there's a WH Smith's in the BBC, just go and sort yourself out and get a sandwich or whatever. So I got a sandwich. I literally sat in this room for a couple of hours until I heard everyone come back. They'd all gone down for a big three-course meal and briefing and whatever. I wasn't even told about any of this. And that's how different I was treated back then.
Why?
Because I was just a copper. Honestly, I mean, things have changed now, but
yeah.
That's how it was. It was so different.
So they weren't seeing you as this person who's coming in with insight, level of insight and expertise that they could bring. It's actually like you're on the outside.
Which is so different to how it is now, because I still do the Crime Watch Roadshow, which is the daily version of the show. And that's exactly why they come to me, to go through all the scripts, to look at all the legals, to look at all the, you know, what's right, what's wrong, how we should word things, because of that expertise. But it was interesting to see that, how different things were.
How long did that take? How long did that take for you to be sort of accepted?
Well, there was a lot of changes and various staff members left. And then that's when things started to change, when new people came in, probably 6 months down the line, right, and treated me as on face value, if you like, and things started to improve pretty dramatically. But it was interesting because I'd always, doesn't matter what I do, I'd always try and be the best of what I could do. And I was still a detective at the end of the day. So even though I'd do the Crime Watch show, I would make sure whatever time I finished, I'd be first in the office in the morning. So no one could say, oh, look at him swanning around or whatever. I'd make sure I was first in there before anyone else. And one time I was doing the Crime Watch show and my next shift was night duty CID. And obviously Crime Watch doesn't finish till like 11, half 11. So I'd go straight from there to my night shift. And there'd been a stabbing, and it was a homeless man. He was fine. He made a recovery. But there was what we call a forensic drying room. So if you've got bloodstained clothes, you can't put them in soaking wet. You have to dry them first before you send them off to a lab when they're dry. And I remember literally an hour after I'd finished the show, I was hanging up a pair of blood-stained homeless man's underpants in a forensic drying room.
Wow.
And I was like, that's keeps you grounded.
Bring
you
it know, down.
Yeah,
bring
absolutely,
it down
bring it down. So there's no sort of showbiz lovey attitude there. Worked a treat, though.
And you stopped then. So at some point, you had to make the decision to no longer do both?
Yeah, it got difficult because I don't know if the way the legal system works, you walk into a Crown Court and then they ask the jury if you know anyone on the prosecution case. And a couple of times the jury members walked out and they said they know me. They don't know me at all. They didn't know me. They just knew who I was. And that's when it really hit me, because I thought, well, this could be bad, because if people are doing this, I've just worked 2 years to get this woman's case to court and I cannot afford to lose potential, you know, jury voters, if you like. And that's when it started to interfere with my work, not through any fault of my own, but I thought this could go pear-shaped. And I had been offered other work, which I'd always turned down, TV work. And I thought, do you know what? If I don't try it, I'll never know. I'm going to take a break for a year. I'm going to try this TV thing, which I've been offered. If it doesn't work, I'll just come straight back to the police. And that was my plan, and that was sort of 10 years ago. That's how it happened. It was just as, just like that. It wasn't a master plan that I'd come up with. It's just how it ended up.
It's fascinating. When you look at your sort of, you know, your upbringing, the British Army, you know, wanted to join the police, went in the police, you know, did all this incredible stuff, saw all this stuff, and then you end up all of a sudden on a TV screen with, you know, as a presenter. You know, it's, for me, it doesn't, for I suppose Crime Watch, the fact that it's Crime Watch makes sense because you've been through so much, you understand so much, you can bring that to the...
Yeah, I think so. But I'd get so much stick all the time for the way I was trying to read voiceovers and I was really struggling. And it wasn't until years later I was diagnosed as being dyslexic. And that's one of the reasons I was struggling to read. I was getting so much stick from the producers at the time. No, you're doing it wrong. You're doing it. And I was thinking, hang on a minute. I'm like a top detective in my day job, and I'm being treated like a 5-year old through no fault of my own. But it's, yeah, it was such an iconic show, especially back then. It really was the pinnacle, and every police officer would watch it because you're looking for your own, you know, suspects, if you like. And it was a great honour to be part of the nighttime one. It still is to be part of the daytime one, but it was, yeah, massive part of my life.
From those other jobs, when you went into, when you had that, I mean, you transitioned multiple times during your career, yeah, you know, today, but have you picked up or do you recognise transferable skills that have happened between the different jobs, careers, organisations?
Yeah. I think the simple ones, like sort of discipline and timekeeping and your personal opinion. I know they sound minor, but I think
they are really
transferable. And for example, in the army, you're late if you are somewhere on time, if that makes sense. So you have to be 5 minutes before. So if you had a team meeting, the rugby team, and they say you've got to be at 12, if you're not sat down at 5:02, you're late in military terms. And that's something I still keep today. I'm ridiculously early for everything because I just wouldn't be late. You know, it just wouldn't happen because I think it's really disrespectful. So that's something I think you get, your self-discipline. I even now, like if people turn up and they've got scruffy shirts and whatever, you're very, very well turned out, I can say, both of you in your 3-piece suits. That's something I think you take. Your discipline, the fact that you have to accept sort of hierarchy, if you like. Again, probably similar to a rugby field, if the captain says something, you do it. Right, you're not all going to give them 14 blokes, give them back chat. That's just not going to get you anywhere. So I think that's something that I'd take from it. But certainly that helped me from the military to the police, definitely the discipline side. Because in the police, if you make the simplest mistake, you could be sacked or jailed. You know, if something's so simple. And I think having come from the army first, where you have to accept the rules and regulations for what they are, I think that really helped me going into the police. And probably helps me today because there's things like social media. It's so easy for anyone to say the wrong thing or to trip up. And I think these are things that you probably take from years of the military, and the police have probably helped me in that respect as well.
It's fascinating chatting to you and the diversity that has, you know, exists in your career. You know, there's other elements to it now as well in terms of the celebrity side of it. So, you know, you've gone through those very serious sort of career paths, and not to say that, sorry, celebrity isn't serious, but like you've also had the enjoyable side of it, which is Strictly Come Dancing, all those sorts of shows, you know.
Sort of say enjoyable, sort of enjoyable.
But so what is, you know, what are the goals now? What are your aspirations? You know, what, because obviously things have changed from those days as a young Jonah wanting to be a policeman.
Yeah.
You know, what are the aspirations now?
Well, I still enjoy what I do. I still enjoy, I've got lots of meetings at the moment about documentaries, which I'm really keen to do. And it's, I think now that I've been doing the sort of telly side of things for so long now, it's like 15 years, if you add it all up, which is a long time. And now I'm at a stage where the sort of big bosses of TV companies are coming to me and asking me for ideas and working on ideas with them, which is really nice to be really well sort of respected in that. And this is someone I'd
love. So behind the scenes stuff, like more?
Yeah, a lot more. Yeah, okay. Yeah, so sort of the production side of things as well, which I really enjoy. Especially, you know, I left school with nothing, you know, so to build up in 15 years is quite nice in that respect. I still got some other TV shows. I still do voiceover work, which I really enjoy as well, which is something, again, I'd never think I'd fall into it, you know, being dyslexic to do a job where you read. But it's something I really enjoy. It's kind of like acting, but whilst you're sat down, you know, it's, but then I don't really think too far ahead. I don't know what I'm going to be doing in 5 years' time. I don't look too far ahead. I'm just, it's just good where I am. You get to do interesting things, chat to you guys. I mean, a few years ago, did you two think you'd be doing this? You know,
I literally thought once I finished playing rugby, I wouldn't see Lewis again.
I moved to Bath to get away from him.
I can't shake him off. He's like a dog on a slipper. He's like a dog on a slipper.
I actually read your book, Year of the Tiger.
Oh, did you?
Back in the day, and he's very complimentary about it.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
Oh, take a little bit of it back.
That was good. I actually had a row with my DI over who the best seven was at the time. It was out of you and Andy Hazel, according to him.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Andy Hazel, Gloucester.
He was a Gloucester guy, DI.
He's now, oh, was he? So your DI was?
My DI was Gloucester, yeah. So I was on your side.
Oh, thanks, mate.
Yeah. Good player, though, Hazy.
He was a good player.
Yeah, he was one of my old teammates.
He's transitioned.
Like, skirmisher.
Yeah.
What
do you mean?
He runs an IT company.
He does, yeah. Very good in IT and tech. He'd be a good one to get on, actually.
Has anyone really shocked you, though, from your rugby days when you find out what they now do for a living? That would be interesting.
Oh.
Because, you know, some people like Kieran Bracken's got an interesting job with
Ice skating?
No, they were getting wood from out in Scandinavia or something, which is...
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Completely different.
Timber frames or something.
That's it,
does,
exactly.
Yeah.
Which is completely different.
You're right, actually, it's interesting.
Yeah,
because
it must be some.
You don't know, do you? We always talk about, you know, if you're lucky, like your dream was to be in the police or the military, once you've done that, and ours may have been play rugby, once you've done that, you feel lucky you've achieved it. A lot of people go through their life and they don't achieve that dream of that work. So when you find it, it's hard to find that second thing that you're passionate about. One of the things we try and talk to people about, certainly when we're talking about the topic of transition, be that military or the sporting world, is find something that you're really passionate about first, then try and find a way of turning that into becoming your job rather than trying to get a job. Like now you're very much involved in TV.
Yeah.
Rewind 20 years. Could you imagine yourself doing what you do now, your day job? And now you're like, you'd say you're living the dream because you love it. It didn't feel like work.
Yeah. I absolutely agree with you that you've got to be passionate about it. And the buzz might be different, okay? You might not be lifting the Heineken Cup, but it's a different kind of passion when you channel it into something else, and whatever the job is, do it the best that you can. And I get a buzz now out of doing a voiceover for a TV show where I get all animated and jumping around. That to me is interesting, but I never would have thought about it when I was running around slogging it up and down the hills, doing a forced march in the army, you know? And it's the same as you guys. But I think that's really important for anyone to...
It's character building, isn't it? So if you think about it, if you look at the stuff you've done, the highs and lows, the stuff that you've seen, it's not, you know, we haven't seen any of that type of stuff. You've heard about it, you see it on TV shows, and you sort of think, oh, I wonder if it's really like that. You've actually lived that, done it.
Yeah.
So that's character that builds you to who you are today.
But I think, on a serious note, I think you have to look out for each other as well. I think that's really important because, you know, the same as rugby as well. You know, one injury and that person's career, male or female, whoever it is, that could be game over. And even though they might be all smiles on the outside, you don't know what's going on the inside. And I think that's really important because it's same for me. You know, I was suddenly chucked out of a job that I was absolutely loving through no fault of my own. And I was lucky to end up getting a job, but I know lots that aren't. And there's, you know, a huge statistic of so many that end up homeless or worse, taking their own lives. And I've certainly lost someone who took his own life, and I had no idea. And so I'm really, really keen to look for the signs and make sure that everyone's all right. And I can imagine sports exactly the same. Yeah. If you're at the professional sport and suddenly it ends, has to end for all of us at some point, some earlier than others, just to looking out for the signs, I think, is really important.
I was going to ask you that because it was one of our earlier episodes where I saw something you said on social media, which prompted us to be sat around the table now. What was it? Do you remember what it was? Something happened on one of our episodes that you sort of commented on.
I was talking about the similarities between the transition between professional sports, rugby in this case, and military when you finally have to leave. And they're so, so similar because I was literally... Well, I was homeless, if you like. I was sofa surfing for a few days until I got somewhere. But it's so similar because you could be training at Leicester Tigers and get a broken leg, and that could be game over so easily. Or someone like, you know, Matt Hampson, top of his game, and then suddenly what happened to him, and it could be all finished. And I think in the army or any element of the military, it's exactly the same. You've got to look out for each other because everyone will say they're fine. Everyone will say, yeah, I'm all right. I've got loads of things lined up. I've got this, I've got that. And deep down, you probably, like I just said at the start of this, I was absolutely bricking it because I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't know where I was going to live. I didn't know how I was going to eat. I didn't know what I was going to do. And that random woman who heard me and how worried I was literally saved me because she got me a job, which did sort me out. And through that job, I got in the police. So I just think it's really important to look out for each other, look for the signs. If someone's a bit withdrawn, if you think something might not be quite right, it probably isn't, and just be there for them. You were there for them in the team. When you're in the rugby team, make sure you're still that team now. Just because you're not playing together, it's still the same unit.
That's really important. That's a really important thing. We talked about that before, about social media doesn't help in that, guys, really, because you sort of see on social media, people look like they are living the dream and they're doing really well. It's only when you have the face-to-face contact where you can actually see someone and actually see, are they okay?
Yeah.
And you're right about reaching out. And we talked about it early on, didn't we, about not understanding. You don't see each other as often, but you can tell quickly in a conversation over a coffee if they're all right, if they need some help or support. Whereas on social media, you'd think, oh no, they're in a good spot. So really.
And it's hard to sometimes, if there are people that you do, I know we've got mates that, you know, struggle various different reasons. But sometimes it's getting them to open up about it and feeling comfortable to talk about it. Because for so long, it's been seen as a sign of weakness, right?
Yeah.
You know, talking about your issues or admitting to, you know, mental health or depression or anxiety or any of that. So actually sometimes even just the fact trying to break down that and have a conversation is difficult, and then get the person to open up about it is even harder. But you're right. I like the idea of just trying to get past that first initial question where it's easy to go, yeah, yeah, I'm, you know, you ask some questions, are you okay? Yeah, yeah, I'm fine. Actually, just to go another question and go, oh, mate, really? You feel, you know, is everything feeling all right? Let's have a chat. Just sometimes people ignore it and then carry on.
And making sure they know you're always there if there's anything you can do to help out. Yeah, it's really important. It doesn't matter what line of work you're in, but it's a horrible thing to have to talk about, but I think it's good. It's getting better.
Yeah,
but I think it will continue to do so.
There's definitely tons of noise about it now, mate. It's been awesome talking to you today. I will finish. I mean, that almost was a piece of advice in itself. But have you ever had or have you got a memory of the best piece of advice that you've ever been given, or something that's really stuck in your memory, you think?
A really simple one, I guess, is Andy Peters.
Yeah,
he's been like my sort of mentor, if you like, for years and years and years. Used to live in, huge rugby fan as well, I have to say.
Yeah. I think he was an agent for a couple of lads.
Yeah, Gloucester.
Yeah, still is.
Someone called Dylan Hartley, you may have heard of. He's very much in the rugby world. But Andy, when I first got the Crime Watch gig and I've been offered these other things, I was like, well, I'm not sure if I should take this or if I just stay where I am or if I should have a crack at this telly business. And it was simple. It's just three words: make it happen. And he said that to me so many times. Look, things aren't going to fall on your lap. Doesn't matter what line of work. If you want it, make it happen. And I think no matter what it is, those three words are really, really important. As much as we probably would like things to fall in our laps and be lovely and, you know, unicorns and rainbows, it doesn't really happen like that. So I use it. I use those three words a lot. If I want something, that's what I say to myself. If someone else wants something to happen, I'll say, well, make it happen then. Do it. What are you going to do? You know, so that would be my advice.
I think that's sound advice, and to get it from Andy Peters.
The man.
Yeah, the man. Was it the broom covered? I can't remember. Where was Andy Peters from?
Do you know
from
170 was bench?
Oh, was it 170
bench.
What, wow. For 10?
Leon's warm up.
Yeah. I'm looking around now. You can see bench press is something he does on
not
a regular basis.
No,
Leon's
near.
Not seen a bench for 15 years. It's like, not seen a chest inverted before, but you know.
He's lean, he's hula hoop a Cheerio.
Yeah. Rav, it's been a pleasure, and as always, thanks everyone for listening. If you've enjoyed the episode today, then please go to Spotify, Apple Podcasts, rate, review, subscribe, or wherever you go to get your podcasts. And until the next time, mate, it's been a pleasure to go through the diversity of your career and the lessons and all the information that you've shared, and for being so open. Thanks very much.
Pleasure, guys. Thank you.
And as always, After the Whistle is brought to you by Audioboom.